This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio and online Main Street across North Dakota. And we're in a brand new year. It's 2021. We've said a not-so-fond farewell to 2020. We learned some lessons, I think, living amongst ourselves with a pandemic. And today we're going to talk about how those lessons might apply to public instruction with the superintendent of the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, Kirsten Baszler. She joins us by phone. Kirsten, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Doug. Happy New Year to you.
And a Happy New Year to you. Christmas Day, I saw an article that was put out by the Forum Communication Service where you were quoted talking about education. Quote, I feel that the nation, and North Dakota included, is on the edge of a cliff of a national crisis. I think we need to expand on that idea.
So I do. So as you remember, in March, March 13th was the day where we had one case, and the governor and I had our first press conference and had said, we will provide some parameters on which our school districts can use to determine whether or not they close their buildings or whether they remain in-person instruction and how they should monitor their community's spread. And over the weekend, things drastically changed. Minnesota was making decisions. Our schools on the eastern part of the state, Fargo, West Fargo, Grand Forks, Wahpeton, were all having community members that were traveling back and forth from Minnesota. We had other, you know, hotspots in the state. Minot was, of course, the ground zero for the first case in North Dakota, but their case number was growing. And so on March 15th, we announced that we would be closing our buildings to in-person instruction. But North Dakota maintained our learning. And by April 1st, we had all of our schools had provided distance learning plan, and all of our students were learning to some degree through the rest of the school year. And so we learned a lot this spring. We provided some guidelines to have a soft reopening of our school buildings for summer school in June of 2020. And in first week of July, we provided guidelines to have our school districts, our local school districts, determine whether or not they would be in-distance learning, 100% face-to-face learning, or a hybrid of the two. And so we have school districts that have been operating in-person learning since August of this year. We've had school districts that have had operating 100% face-to-face since August of this year, and we've had a mix of in-between. But as we move through this, what we've learned, Doug, is that, well, it's not is distance learning good or bad? Is distance learning effective or ineffective? What we know is that because we didn't have a lot of time to prepare our teachers, their students, and their families for in-distance learning or distance learning versus in-person learning, no one was fully prepared to execute that model of instruction as well as we wanted to be and as well as we needed to be. And so while we've continually gotten better, our students have become more accustomed to distance learning. Our teachers have certainly become more accustomed to distance teaching. We are not where we need to be to have the 100% effectiveness of this new type of learning in our schools. And until we understand that we are needing to drastically support our schools, our teachers in those schools, and most importantly, our students and their families, this is not the most ideal way for us to be teaching our students at this point in time. Without that adequate support, the adequate resources, the adequate training, and the adequate preparation for everybody to ramp up. So what I was speaking of in that quote was, we knew that there would be I hate to say learning loss, and I would say this disruption of in-person learning without adequate preparation, it has caused our students to not grow at the rate that they need to grow academically each week, each month, each semester. And so the nation needs to understand that we could use Hurricane Katrina as an example, that it took those students that suddenly had to abruptly discontinue a learning model that they were accustomed to, it took them years to catch up to the learning growth that is deserved to them. We now have an entire nation of abruptly disrupting a learning delivery model and the adequate instruction and teaching and learning environment that our students and our teachers are used to. So as a nation, we have to understand that we aren't simply going to be able to go back once the virus is conquered. We're not going to be able to go back and say, oh, kids will pick up right where they left off. You know, they left this type of learning when they were third graders, and now they're going to return to a similar normal model as fifth graders, and they could just start learning fifth grade material. We have to recognize that there's going to be additional support, guidance, and resources that will be necessary for them to catch up to where they need to be and continue to make up the adequate learning growth that they deserve.
So you're talking about a remedial education strategy that's in the works post-vaccination, probably. Are we talking about summer school for all?
We hope so. Obviously, we have a very strong local control state and a very strong nation comprised of local control states. And so ultimately, we need to be respecting our families' desires and wishes. But what I know that we need to do as a nation and as a state is to provide the funding, the resources, and the infrastructure to allow our school districts to offer that summer school for all. We need to provide the funding, and we need to provide the support for our teachers and help them create schedules and an infrastructure that will allow our students to make up the time that they've lost and continue to grow. We also need to focus on supporting our teachers and our families on how do we ensure that the distance learning environments, because some of our students have accelerated. How do we ensure that what we've learned during this time for those students that are very self-motivated and learn well in this distance learning model, that opportunity and that option doesn't go away when we go back to in-person learning as well.
But this is a circumstance that has emphasized the haves and the have-nots. The pandemic has really put that under a stark light. Have low-income students been more adversely affected? Have you been able to really study the delivery and the reception of the educational product?
Yes, Doug, that is clearly. So what we did, anticipating and suspecting that there would be learning loss, I think we all knew that there would be a significant amount of disrupted learning loss that was occurring. And so we analyzed our fall NWEA MAP scores from fall of 2020, compared those to fall of 2019. And what we learned was there was about a 25 to 28% dip in our students that were performing on grade level in reading, writing, and mathematics. So about 1 in 4 of every of our students that were performing on grade level in those three subject areas in the fall of 2019, they were no longer performing and doing on grade level work in math, reading, and writing. As you stated clearly, that loss was even more significant for our students with special needs, our students who were socioeconomically disadvantaged, our students that were living in poverty, and for those students that our English wasn't their first language, so our EL students. So the learning loss there and the amount of loss that was that our students occurred was more profound in those subgroup areas. So as you said, the haves and the have-nots, those families, and maybe they weren't even living in poverty, but their families may have been the frontline workers. They may be the nurses and the healthcare providers and their long-term care providers, our frontline workers, our emergency responders. If you didn't have a very strong family support system that was able to help guide you through that distance learning process, you were certainly at a disadvantage. If you were a student with special needs that was accustomed to additional supports from people, human resources, additional instruction, or your speech therapy or your OT or your PT supports that schools provide, you experienced more significant loss. And so not only summer school for all, but how do we now be strategic and laser-like as we provide additional supports to those students that had a significant hit in their learning? How do we make sure that gap isn't just closed at a rate that the other students' rates are closed, but how do we target those students to ensure that their learning loss is accelerated, or the recovery from their learning loss is accelerated so that gap can be closed?
Kirsten Basler is superintendent of the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction. And Kirsten, in preparing for this discussion, I came across something called North Dakota Exact Path. This is a precision learning tool to help determine a student's place in the core education areas. Is this something that's going to be widely applied to kind of assess where somebody is?
So, yes, thank you for bringing that up. So early on, that's our job at the department, is to try to ensure that we are five steps ahead of what our schools are needing. So anticipating that our students would be experiencing some sort of quarantine or isolation, or that there would be this learning loss, what we did is we secured a statewide contract for all of the students in North Dakota. So all of our school districts could utilize this exact path. The Department of Public Instruction tried to act as that educational Red Cross, just as when there's a flood or there's an earthquake or other crisis within a community or some other natural disaster, the Red Cross provides the essentials. They provide the blankets, the shelter, the clean water, the food to our locales when they're trying to do other things. That's what the Department of Public Instruction did. We partnered with the governor's office to provide this to all of our students. And what it is a precision learning tool. So teachers don't have to, they can spend their time building relationships, and they can deliver the very precise learning journey for each student, meeting each student where they are in mathematics, English, language arts, which includes the reading and the writing. And that student then has their own personalized learning journey. We have a tremendous amount of our school districts are using this as their distance learning tool. And very excited that will be available through this school year. It'll be available through the summer up into September of 2021. If our school districts continue to use it in the manner that we are seeing that they're using it, and they're yielding extremely good results, North Dakota Department of Public Instruction will continue to provide that to our school districts. It's also available to any family that wants to sign their child up. So think of it as a personalized tutor. Instead of taking your child to a private tutor or maybe one of a business that provides tutoring within your community, you can sign your child up, your grandchild up for this. And they can use it as supplemental learning to the learning that is going on in their school buildings or with their teachers on an online delivery. So that is our attempt to ensure that North Dakota is one of those states that is able to minimize the learning delay for our students and able to accelerate the recovery from this pandemic for our learning.
Well, as you know, the legislature is getting underway, and everybody's going to be coming to the legislature sort of hat in hand, asking for some probably additional help to deal with the pandemic emergency as it related to their agency. How would you describe the financial impact of the pandemic on North Dakota's budget for public instruction?
So it has been an incredibly challenging scenario for our local school districts to navigate. So we have teachers that are teaching. They're the only secondary math teacher in a school district. Let's use Kindred or Turtle Lake. And so you have a math teacher that is teaching six periods of mathematics, seventh grade math, eighth grade math, ninth grade algebra, so on and so forth. So they're developing all of these lesson plans for all of the math classes for their in-person students. But on any given day, they have anywhere from 7 to 12% of their students doing distance learning. So they're needing to develop six different lesson plans for those distance learners. And so our school districts have done a fabulous job of ensuring that those teachers are compensated, that they are hiring the substitute teachers in order to provide the distance learning support and the in-person support. So the impact has been incredible on the instructional side, not to mention the transportation side of things or the food delivery side of things. The human resource, the cost of the human resources, because of the social distancing that's required, more personnel are needing to be hired to do bus routes. More personnel is needing to be hired to get our students through the food service lines because we need longer and we need fewer people in our cafeterias. And so the legislature will have some significant challenges as they determine how to appropriate dollars to support this extra added additional burden of our school districts. The federal government has provided support. They provided $33 million in the first CARES Act round of funding for K-12 schools. We're anticipating another $127 million that will come to North Dakota from the federal government and the second CARES dollars that was just approved just before Christmas. And so we'll work with the legislature to determine how that federal funding can be braided and incorporated with our state funding to ensure that our students have what they need, that our teachers have what they need. And that's kind of how I began this conversation. We need to understand that that type of level of support is absolutely necessary. If we don't invest now, that's the crisis that I believe that this nation is on the verge of. If we don't invest the dollars in a speedy recovery, we will have long-term effects. The JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, did a study, produced a report in November that shared with us a model that they did as the American Medical Association that said, we will have long-term effects where we are losing over 5.53 million years in life, of future life of these students right now, because of their lost education, their lost nutritional education, their lost education that leads to jobs that are of higher risk and higher mortality rate. So that is, we need to invest now to prevent what we could see as a disaster in the state's economy if we don't have an educated workforce and our students are trying to recover as they move on to post-secondary world or work life.
Well, you mentioned the workload for teachers, particularly when this thing broke. They were suddenly creating a couple of lesson plans, maybe, one online and one in person. What is the stress on that occupation in North Dakota right now? Are teachers resigning? Is there burnout? I saw a Minnesota survey that showed about a third of the teachers they surveyed were thinking about retiring or leaving the profession.
Thank you. The stress on our teachers is just incredible. Stress has been put on everyone, our students, our families who are suddenly needing to be, providing that instructional support at home. But our school teachers most certainly are receiving they're shouldering a tremendous amount of burden and a tremendous amount of stress, as are our administrators, our school support workers, school board members, everyone involved with K-12 is experiencing that success. North Dakota numbers are similar. Our North Dakota Association, North Dakota United, did a survey, and if I'm remembering the numbers correctly, just over 50%, under 51% of our teachers were strongly committed to returning to school to teaching next year. That means almost 50% are not committed to returning to school. We had a teacher shortage before this pandemic occurred. We will certainly be facing a teacher shortage. And so we really need to, again, the national crisis that we are on the verge of. If the most certain way, research has proven that learning is impacted by having quality, effective teachers in front of our students. We need to do everything that we can to have those effective, quality teachers be supported so they return to our classrooms this summer, next fall. If we don't have that quality, effective teaching force in our classrooms, our road to recovery for these students will be all the more challenging. So it really is time for us to step up, support our quality, effective teachers, support those quality, effective administrators, ensure that we're supporting them and that we are adequately providing the resources that they need to be effective in their classrooms, be effective teachers to our learners.
You mentioned the importance of education to providing, lifelong success, if you will, better jobs, better health outcomes that are connected with those kinds of opportunities. Has there been any way to assess the dropout rate that has resulted from this serious disruption?
Yes, and so that is actually the report that we're working on. I have a meeting at 1 o'clock to discuss this work. We will be able to compare the enrollment numbers. The North Dakota Department of Public Instruction tracks and records enrollment numbers. So we do know that we have a dip in enrollment this year, whether that's because some families have delayed their students' registration into kindergarten and are waiting for a year for it to be a more normal experience. We don't know if some of those enrollment declines have been caused by the the correlating dip in the energy sector has some of those families that were formerly in our energy counties in Western North Dakota. Have they moved back closer to home to be with families, you know, from the states that they had come from before? We don't know if it's students that were reached the age of 16 and didn't need to enroll, or simply opted out of distance learning. So we have access to that information, and we are working with our local school district, our North Dakota Information Technology Department, and our North Dakota University system to do an analysis of exactly where are those students, where are those missing students. We also know that we have a number of students that enrolled but are simply not attending. They have not engaged in learning. They have not signed into their distance learning. So we are working with North Dakota Department of Human Services as well to identify who those students are. So we should have some numbers and some percentages available publicly soon after, you know, into this new year.
It sounds, though, that the gut reaction is that there will be some not so good result of that.
Yes, and even for our alternative high schools, for our students that were, you know, working toward, you know, attending an alternative high school, working towards their high school diploma, or our adult education services centers that are in collaboration with our alternative high schools that are working towards their general equivalency diploma, the GED, we know that those students do better in face-to-face learning environments with consistency and continuity. We know that they are struggling. So again, knowing that we had the learning loss, we do know that there will be students that an increased number of dropouts, an increased number of students that aren't making significant progress toward a high school diploma. Just how much of a percentage of our students are impacted and how much of an increase, we're working on more specifics of those numbers. But we do know that it will be an increase. Just how big of an increase is the unknown that we're working on to get specific numbers.
That newspaper article I referenced earlier also had another quote from you. It related to the benefits of the pandemic. The term was rip the Band-Aid off things that weren't working well before the emergency. So what wasn't working well and what really needs attention?
So we really, what really needs attention is two things. We need to continue to nurture and cultivate the critical relationship between school and home. If there's one positive thing, the most positive thing that has come from this pandemic, is the understanding of the necessary relationship between school and home. As important is the support that we need to provide professional development to not only our classroom teachers, but to also the support staff, the teacher's aide, and all of the others that are involved in a child's instructional education daily work. We need to provide them with the professional development, because teaching in a distance learning environment is not the same as teaching in a face-to-face environment. You have to have different strategies. You can't just simply have a student sit in front of a computer for 50 minutes a day and have it be the same encounter, the same experience as when that student is in a classroom. The third issue that we've been tweaking around the edges is, how do we understand how we fund our school districts? Right now, we fund our school districts on our per pupil foundation aid payment formula that's based on how long our students sit in a seat in a classroom in a brick and mortar building. So we have lots of questions that we need to work with our legislators on, lots of different ideas that have been floated out there, but everybody's been, you know, it's super complex. But again, we've jumped off the diving board into the deep end, and it's time for us to figure those things out, because our students do want to learn in this new environment. Our, as you see, employers and employees are working in that environment all across this nation and this world. So how do we truly mirror that real life work world in our K-12 system?
Kirsten Basler is superintendent of the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction. Kirsten, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Doug, and Happy New Year again. Appreciate all you do.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about Strengthen North Dakota. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. House Majority Leader Chet Pollard says he can support some bonding in this legislative session, but Pollard says he thinks there has to be some limits on it. Governor Burgum has proposed a bonding program, and so have other legislators. They suggest using the proceeds of the legacy fund to pay off the bonds, but Pollard says lawmakers need to be careful.
Regrettably, we're going to need some of these legacy fund earnings to fill these gaps for the 21-23 biennium, you know, because a lot of these proposals, how are they going to pay for everything? Are they going to raid the budget stabilization fund and the strategic investment and infrastructure fund?
As far as the uses of the legacy fund, Pollard says he would like to see a matrix set up.
Some of it goes back into the principle of the legacy fund earnings to keep that going. Because as you know, with technologies and the way everything is going, you know, fracking and all that 30 years from now, I think that's a good question, Mark. Will that be there? So we need to have these funds for the future generations, just not now.
Pollard says voters approved the legacy fund so future generations can benefit from it. Fargo Democratic Senator Tim Mathern has introduced a $2 billion bonding bill. Mathern says it has four purposes. One is to fully fund the Prairie Dog local infrastructure bill.
We passed a bill last legislative session without enough money in it. So we promised a lot of people money, and this bonding would pay for that so that these organizations would get that money.
Mathern says a second purpose would be for other infrastructure needs as identified by the Upper Great Plains Transportation Institute.
That has measured township roads, county roads, state roads, federal roads, and so it would put money towards those projects going forward.
Other identified purposes would be to put money into a fund for infrastructure for schools going from kindergarten through college. Mathern says that fund would provide loans at 2% interest, and the other purpose would be for the Housing Finance Agency to build more low-income housing. And Minnesota health officials are already starting to look ahead to the next phase of coronavirus vaccinations. Right now, the shots are reserved for the so-called 1A group, or healthcare and residents of long-term care facilities. That process is expected to take most of January. Next up is 1B, or frontline and essential workers, plus those over 75. Minnesota Infectious Disease Director Chris Ayersman says they hope to release more guidance around the week of January 18th.
Consistent approach. And so if we find that one part of the state has been able to get through, say, all the tiers of phase 1A, then we would not provide them with vaccine and rather redirect that vaccine to other regions where they had not gotten to that point.
A total of 417,832 cases have been detected in Minnesota since the start of the pandemic. That also includes 5,430 deaths. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. A touchstone energy cooperative generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The Minot-based nonprofit Strengthen ND supports rural development across the state. It does that by writing grants and by identifying who might benefit or be strengthened by an idea. Executive Director Megan Lautenschlager recently sat down with Prairie Public's John Harris for the Prairie Pulse television show.
Well, you're the executive director of Strengthen ND. What is Strengthen ND?
Sure. Strengthen ND at its core is a capacity building organization. So our goal is to work with nonprofits, rural communities, and tribal communities to really help them be better. And we really try to support and accelerate community development in a couple of different strategies. The first being building nonprofit and community capacity. The second being advancing regional issues. And the third being facilitating community solutions. So we like to say that we're all in for rural North Dakota. We're here to support and help communities capitalize on the great opportunities that they have.
Well, now, you founded this. Did you do this yourself or with anybody?
So in 2014, I was lucky enough to be selected by the Bush Foundation out of the Twin Cities as a Bush Foundation Fellow. And through that work and that great continuing education that I was able to receive, it became more and more clear that there was a disparity between some of North Dakota's more urban areas and really the rural and tribal communities around what type of opportunities they were able to capitalize on. So I was coming out of a position more in traditional philanthropy and just kind of seeing that traditional philanthropy can sometimes exacerbate those issues. So when that position was moving forward, we decided we really need an organization to really fill a lot of the gaps here in North Dakota. So along with three other amazing women, we founded Strengthen ND. The three women served as the initial incorporating board of directors, and I was able to be the executive director and kind of dig in and start doing the work.
So how many staff do you have and how are you funded?
Sure. So right now we have four staff, four amazing women. When we were founded, we knew that relying on grants to fund us in perpetuity was probably not going to be a great strategy. So with that, we are about 40% grant funded and 60% funded through fee-for-service. So that's a lot of client work that we do that is, you know, kind of paid by the hour, whether that be community planning, strategic planning, grant writing. It's a way for us to have some revenue-generating opportunity instead of relying on typical grants. But having said that, we are grateful to be a Bush Foundation ecosystem grantee. So they provide us operating dollars for the next 3 years. And the Otto Bremer Trust, too, has provided us operating dollars since we were founded.
Okay. So how have you seen it grown over the last, I guess, 5 years or so?
Yeah. So I think one of the pieces that we really focused on when we initially were founded in 2015, 2016, was trying to identify where kind of our core services would be. So we started out pretty wide in what we were trying to do. And as we have grown over the years and been able to add staff and really understand what the true gaps are and where we can be most complementary, we've kind of narrowed our services down. So in effect, we've gone deeper with clients than we had in the past. And we've been able to extend our reach throughout about a third of North Dakota's rural and tribal communities. So we have seen our impact deepen and also grow throughout the state.
Okay. I've got a list of a number of initiatives or programs or so I'm going to just, instead of asking you to tell me about them in general, I'm going to ask about individual ones. What is Rural Matters Initiative?
So our Rural Matters Initiative is something that we started to roll out a few months ago and is something that we are hoping to really expand in 2021. We know that 2020 has been a difficult year for many nonprofit communities, nonprofits in rural communities and tribal communities. And Rural Matters is a way for us to gather input from people who are living and working in rural North Dakota about what is most important to them. So we have worked with a local artist, Molly McLean, out of Bismarck, and she's designed four postcards for us. And our goal with this project is to have people complete the postcard, and on the postcard it says what's most important to you about living in rural North Dakota. And we're going to take all of that feedback that we receive and utilize it in a couple of different ways. First, it will be a statewide kind of art piece, so it will be turned into a publication that we can disseminate across the state. Second, it will be an advocacy piece, so for foundations or other entities that are operating here in rural North Dakota who may not understand the nuance or culture, we hope to share this publication with them as a way to advocate for rural North Dakota. And lastly, we're going to utilize it for programmatic adjustments that we may need to have, because we've done a great deal of research and data gathering around what North Dakota's needs are, but we've never directly asked North Dakotans. So this is a way for us to kind of check how we are rolling out programs to make sure that we are being most effective.
Well, what impact has COVID had on rural communities, I guess, in North Dakota?
Yeah, so COVID is, as you know, impacting everywhere. And I think one of the bright spots that we're seeing in some of the really small communities is that they're utilizing this as an opportunity to think forward. So if you can see that many rural grocery stores, especially in very small communities like the community of Tuttle, which has 60 people, their grocery store has had some of their very best months in operation during times of COVID because people are trying to stay home. I think that across the nation, we're seeing people are more interested in gardening and knowing really where their food comes from. So I think those are opportunities that rural communities are looking at to figure out how they can capitalize on them. And lastly, I think COVID is really bringing to light how valuable and important our local healthcare facilities are and how valuable and important the staff are at our elder care facilities. So rural communities are definitely being impacted, but I see a lot more optimism in rural communities around how they can actually capitalize on new trends and be able to make their communities better.
Yeah. What is your funding opportunity database?
Yeah, our funding opportunity database. So we launched a website redesign earlier in the fall of 2020. And as a part of that, we wanted to make sure that not only do nonprofits, rural communities, and tribal communities have the tools they need to effectively seek out different grant writing opportunities or to effectively secure funding, but that they had at least a starting point to be able to figure out what type of opportunities are out there. So our funding opportunity database is basically categorized about 300 opportunities around quality of life, workforce development, capital and infrastructure, municipal-only funding that people can search for when they're looking, okay, we have this need in our community. We've got some momentum in this area. Now what opportunities may be there? So it's not the end-all, be-all of databases, but it is meant to be just a great start.
Well, you mentioned tribal, and what programs are geared, I guess, specifically toward Native reservations?
Yeah. So North Dakota has 5 Native nations that share our geography. And when we have been thinking about how Strengthen ND grows and how we become more equitable with the way that we provide all services, we realize that our Native nations have to be supported for their own self-determination. And with that, we brought on Stacy LeCompte as our Indigenous Communications and Tribal Advocate. And she brings to our organization about 2 decades worth of tribal economic development experience. So we now, with her being on the team, offering some business development supports and technical assistance for Native business owners, particularly those who are Native artists or who are engaged in the tourism economy. And this is especially timely as well with COVID because tourism has all but gone to a screeching halt, and a lot of our Native nations have kind of tourism-based economies. So she's able to work with Native business owners, work with tribal governments, work with other Native-led entities to figure out how we develop those economic development strategies along with those kind of one-on-one technical assistance pieces that can be vital as a business owner is operating and adjusting.
Well, let's go to a couple more things you've got. What is the Shared Kitchen Toolkit?
Shared Kitchen Toolkit. So when we were looking at what was needed for rural communities and tribal communities, we decided to pull together somewhat of a resource library. And the Shared Use Kitchen Toolkit is something that we were able to find. And we think that with North Dakota's agricultural-based economy, with the emerging trends around people wanting to know where their food comes from and being engaged in actually manufacturing their own food, we wanted to make sure that that was available. So that's a toolkit that is on our site. We didn't author it. It's a product of USDA, but it's a great way for communities to think about how they utilize their shared kitchen space, whether that be at a senior living facility, in a hospital, or anywhere else in their community to support not only healthy access to healthy and fresh foods, but also ways for people to generate revenue during these times of COVID and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going on to another toolkit, the Urban Agriculture Toolkit.
Yeah, the Urban Agriculture Toolkit, too, is a product of USDA, and that's something that is on our site as well. Again, kind of thinking about COVID and people's interest in gardening and urban gardening and what does community gardening look like, we included that on our website because we think that that's a great way for communities to give back to one another, for people who are seeking food challenges, especially in North Dakota's many food deserts, to have greater access to fresh and healthy foods in order to, you know, as well as to build community. So that is another toolkit that we've included, and that plays into our broader initiative around building resilient farm country. We think that we can spur greater outcomes for North Dakota as a whole, as well as individual communities, if we think about going back to our small-scale farming roots. And whether that's community gardening or micro-farming, we think that North Dakotans can be successful by really embracing those roots and utilizing them to feed their families and to hopefully make a profit.
Yeah. Now, you have some events, I guess, but what kind of events do you have in 2021 that maybe you've rescheduled because you had to postpone because of COVID?
Yeah. So one event that we are extremely excited about and looking forward to that did have to be rescheduled because of COVID is the concert that we have called A Unique Evening of North Dakota Music. So the Tuttle Rural Innovation Center is this great space in Kidder County, and they are looking at how they can build a regional economic development hub. And as a part of that hub, there's an event space. And with the support of the North Dakota Council on the Arts, this great event featuring North Dakota artists like Keith Bear, like the Larson Brothers, was planned. And we are hoping to bring that back and to be able to do that in 2021 because it's a great way to, again, build community with rural North Dakotans, to highlight all of the great talent that we have here in North Dakota, and to just kind of keep remembering and highlighting North Dakota's great, unique culture.
Okay. Well, let's go to some of your other programs. What is the Change Network?
Sure. The Change Network is an initiative that was funded originally by the Bush Foundation and is still funded by the Bush Foundation. We have been able to be a partner with National Arts Strategies out of Washington, D.C. National Arts Strategies is an international organization that does a lot of technical assistance and capacity building for artists and arts-based organizations. And they were able to secure the funds from the Bush Foundation and asked to partner with Strengthen ND to deploy a cohort program that supports North Dakota leaders to think across difference and to work across difference. So it's a one-year cohort program that has about 20 people every year from North Dakota who attend and participate. And you get great training around how to navigate difficult conversations. Like I said, how to work across difference, how to recognize both your conscious and unconscious bias. So it's supporting North Dakota leaders to build a community amongst themselves, as well as to be agile in the way that they enact leadership in their communities so that all North Dakotans can have access to great programs or be able to live in great communities. It was launched in 2017. We are on our fourth cohort this year, and we will be looking to recruit cohort number 5 this spring.
Well, now you say you're going to recruit, but I was going to ask you, and not necessarily about Change Network, but about any of your programs or initiatives we talk about, do you recruit people or do people raise their hand and say, I'd like to be involved?
Mm. One of our core values of Strengthen ND is that we don't go into a community unless we're invited in. So it's a mixture. With the initiatives that we have planned and the type of assistance that we're rolling out, it's very much in response to what we're hearing from communities and in response to what they're saying that they need. So in that effect, it's kind of feeding into us. But with Change Network and with our other programs like the Nonprofit Certificate Program, we definitely utilize the connections that we have across the state to say, hey, do you know of anybody who would be interested in participating in this? Or how about you submit an application?
Okay. You mentioned nonprofit certificate program. That's my next question. What is that?
Yeah. So the nonprofit certificate program is something that's really special to me because this was the kind of kickoff initiative that we had at Strengthen ND. A lot of people who enter the nonprofit field, I think, somewhat have a similar background to me where they didn't know where they wanted to land or didn't even know that working in nonprofits was an option as a career for them. So the nonprofit certificate program is meant to support individuals interested in entering the field, potential board members or current board members, as well as existing nonprofit staff, to really learn the fundamentals needed to effectively run an organization. So through this six-month program, we teach things like strategic planning and action planning, nonprofit finance, grant seeking and grant writing, board governance, all of those core functions that you need to know how to do well to have a healthy organization.
Okay. Moving on, I guess, to another program, the Building Resilient Farm Country program.
Yeah. So Building Resilient Farm Country is a program that is really near and dear to, I think, everybody on the team's hearts, as well as something that we think could be incredibly powerful for rural North Dakota. So Bill Davis, who is a mentor of mine, somebody who really helped me to get connected and to better understand rural North Dakota, came up with this idea. He said, "We know we have thousands of vacant farmsteads across North Dakota. What if we tried to do something with them?" So he put that bug in our ear, and we kind of stewed on it for a few years and thought, okay, well, what if we really were to do this? There's so many great kind of elements that we can capitalize on when we're thinking about vacant or idle farmsteads, whether it be the huge investment in the infrastructure that's already there, whether it be roads, water, electric, right? Like we've made those investments. So our hope with Building Resilient Farm Country is that we can catalyze greater opportunities for North Dakota and rural communities by repopulating those vacant or idle farmsteads. And also going back to what I mentioned earlier of embracing our small scale farming roots. So what if we were able to repopulate those farmsteads? What if we were able to support those living there to engage in micro farming, either to feed their family or to make a profit, and knowing too that they would need to have off farm income. But what would that look like? What type of impact would that have for rural communities? And whether it be economic impact or being able to keep schools open longer simply because there are more kids. So there's a great many benefits that could be reaped from it that we were just incredibly excited to dig in. So we have built out Building Resilient Farm Country into a few phases. We are almost done with phase one, which is the initial feasibility study. So we took an 8-county area in northern North Dakota and said, okay, within this area, how many vacant or idle farmsteads are in existence and how many of them are actually usable? So we did that feasibility study and found that about 200 vacant or idle farmsteads exist, and most of them are viable. So we're wrapping up that feasibility study to better understand the local food systems in that region and how we move forward. And the second phase of Building Resilient Farm Country is really looking at how do we support rural communities to embrace people who aren't from rural North Dakota or who may look differently from us. And that's our work with Narrative Change with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Well, and I'm sorry because we're out of time. So it takes four amazing women, I'm sure, to get all this done. But if people want more information, where can they go? Who can they contact?
Yeah, they can go to our website, strengthennd.com.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Strengthen ND Executive Director Megan Lautenschlager in a conversation with John Harris for the Prairie Pulse television show. Dakota Datebook is next.
When Wendy Wood tried to start a 6 a.m. workout routine, she dreaded it. So she thought of a creative solution.
I actually slept in my running clothes because it made it easier to then get up and just get out the door.
How our habits form and ways to take control of them. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public. when you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 4th. The Garrison Dam is the fifth largest earthen dam in the world. Made by packing down dirt with other materials, its total volume is 66.5 million cubic yards of earth fill and 1.5 million cubic yards of concrete. However, underneath its many layers is a sad story. The dam was part of the Pick Sloan Project, a plan for flood control and power generation. It required the purchase and flooding of 152,360 acres in the Fort Berthold Reservation, home to the three affiliated tribes. So in April of 1946, the Corps of Engineers began the project. Interestingly, the Corps altered the project's specifications to protect Williston, but didn't do anything to protect the tribes. Instead, they threatened eminent domain, so the tribes brought the issue to Washington. Based on the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851, Congress halted expenditures for the dam until the tribes received a suitable settlement. On October 29, 1949, Harry S. Truman signed the final settlement. The tribes were compensated a total of $12.6 million, $5.1 million for losses, and $7.5 million in additional benefits. They estimated it was $9 million under market value for the damages sustained. The settlement also denied their request for irrigation development and royalty rights for subsurface materials in the reservoir area, shutting them out of a large portion of the dam's benefits. They couldn't even use the reservoir shoreline for grazing, hunting, fishing, or other traditional purposes. They began their relocation over the next few years. Land appraisers came to Fort Berthold on November 13, 1950. They suggested the people accept or reject appraisals made in 1948, and the majority accepted. Around this date, they completed the road surveys and finally began construction for the new town of Newtown. By 1954, they had finished relocation and built the road system and schoolhouses and even moved churches and cemeteries to new locations. All in all, 300 families and 1,700 residents were forced to relocate. And while this recent generation has worked hard to counter the effects, the damage from the Garrison Dam is still felt. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic, The Great Gatsby, enters the public domain this year, giving author Michael Farris Smith a chance to spin off one of the novel's supporting characters.
I thought it would be so interesting if someone were to write Nick's story, because you know so little about him in Gatsby.
What inspired his new prequel, plus the latest on Georgia's Senate runoff races, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you know, as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on Main Street, we'll continue our conversations about how the pandemic has affected virtually every business. We'll talk with Alex Rydell. He's the president of the North Dakota Funeral Directors Association. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.